From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Darling, you send me.
Sam Cooke's You Send Me went to number one in 1957. It sold over 2 million copies. Cooke was murdered in 1964 at the age of 33, but in those few years, he hit the charts repeatedly with such songs as Wonderful World, Chain Gang, and Only 16. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Daniel Wolfe, author of a new biography of Sam Cooke called You Send Me, and S.R. Crane, who founded the gospel quartet The Soul Stirrers, which launched Sam Cooke's recording career. Also today, we talk with Adam Egoyan about his new film, Exotica. The film is set in a strip club, but nothing is what it seems to be. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
But ooh, it's lasted so long. Now I find myself.
First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has wrapped up 2 days of talks with Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozyrev in Geneva. As NPR's Andy Bowers reports, the two found numerous issues dividing them.
Russia's ongoing war in Chechnya will keep it from joining the elite group of seven industrial nations this year. Secretary Christopher said Russian President Yeltsin will attend the upcoming G7 summit the same way he did last year, as a political but not an economic partner. Christopher cited Russia's loss of international status over the Chechen war. The two also failed to resolve their disputes over Russia's proposed sale of nuclear reactors to Iran or the expansion of NATO into Central Europe, two topics sure to come up at a presidential summit in Moscow this May. In addition, the Russian minister presented Christopher with a new peace plan for Bosnia, which his country has worked out with Serbia, but Kozyrev declined to give any details. I'm Andy Bowers in Geneva.
Japanese police say the chemicals they found today at a religious sect's complex are so dangerous they had to suspend their search, but they'll go back again tomorrow with Army chemical experts. The sect is being investigated in connection with the deadly gas attack on the Tokyo subway. The sect denies the chemicals are used to make weapons and says they are for welding and processing computer chips. The group's leader accuses the Japanese government of framing the sect. German authorities have raided the homes of suspected right-wing extremists and seized illegal Nazi propaganda printed in the United States. Now German officials want Denmark to extradite the American publisher, who was arrested there earlier this week. NPR's Deidre Berger reports.
The Hamburg state prosecutor says Gary Lauck has been arrested by Danish police. He is wanted in Germany for exporting right-wing propaganda material from the U.S. to Germany. Hundreds of German police throughout the country this morning raided the homes of about 80 people thought to be working for Lauck in Germany. The police confiscated large amounts of neo-Nazi literature published in the U.S. by Lauck, who is one of the largest publishers in the world of neo-Nazi propaganda material. The nationwide raid was organized by the Federal Criminal Office. U.S. authorities have repeatedly told Bonn they cannot intervene in the production of Lauck's neo-Nazi material because of freedom of speech laws. I'm Deidre Berger reporting.
UN officials say Bosnian government troops are gaining strategic high ground in northeastern Bosnia. The Bosnian Serb news agency says Serbian military leaders deny the reports. That region is important to the Serbs because it's their supply corridor to Serbs in western Bosnia and parts of Croatia. The U.S. says the government troops made their gains despite a snowfall that would normally have halted fighting, and that shows the government army's abilities are improving. On Wall Street, just before the close, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up nearly 4 points. This is NPR. The National Labor Relations Board says it probably won't decide before next week whether to seek a court injunction that could end the Major League Baseball players' strike. The board has been considering asking a federal judge to order team owners to reinstate the players' old work rules. The union has said it will suspend the strike if that injunction is granted. But board chairman William Gould said today that the five board members still have complex legal issues to consider before deciding whether to go to court. Republican governors met with House Speaker Newt Gingrich and Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole today. The talks focused on welfare reform. The governors expressed strong support for Republican proposals. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
While the governors met, the House was voting on a series of amendments to the Republican welfare reform package. One Democratic amendment, slated for a vote tomorrow, would require welfare recipients to at least be looking for work in order to receive benefits. Republican Governor Association Chairman Mike Leavitt of Utah singled out that amendment for attack.
It is counterfeit reform. There is no reform. It is not innovation. It is the status quo, no change.
The governor said Democrats in Congress paint the states as uncaring and hostile towards children. Several governors insisted they do care. That's why they don't want to leave children mired in the current system. They favor the Republican plan because it gives them the greatest flexibility to design their own alternatives to welfare. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
A key witness says the government offered him $45,000 to inform on Malcolm X's daughter in an alleged murder-for-hire plot. Michael Fitzpatrick testified today in St. Paul, Minnesota, at a pretrial hearing for Kabila Shabazz, who is charged with hiring Fitzpatrick to kill Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan. Farrakhan was never attacked. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a revival of interest in the late Sam Cooke. It's sparked by the release of a new biography and a new box set of reissued recordings by Cooke and others that originally came out on Cooke's own label, SAR Records. The new biography, You Send Me, is written by Daniel Wolfe in cooperation with a couple of Cooke's close associates, including S.R. Crane, the founder of the Soul Stirrers, the gospel group that Cooke first recorded with. Author Daniel Wolfe joins us from New York. S.R. Crane, founder of the Soul Stirrers, joins us from San Francisco. The new biography investigates the circumstances behind Cooke's mysterious death over 30 years ago. At the age of 33, Sam Cooke was shot through the heart in a seedy motel room. Sam Cooke is best remembered for his soul hits You Send Me, Only 16, Chain Gang, Cupid, Twistin' the Night Away, Bring It On Home to Me, and Shake. He started his career in a teenage gospel group. When he was 19, he was picked by S.R. Crane to replace the retiring lead singer of the Soul Stirrers, the legendary R.H. Harris. This is the Soul Stirrers with Sam Cooke singing lead.
Lord, up there, I'll meet my mother. Lord, up there, I'll meet my mother. Well, while angels sing and joy be reign and glory. Lord, I fall from my from Canaan. Lord, when I get on home, my Savior, I join. Well, I shout, God knows I'm going to dwell. Shout, hey, Lord, God knows I'm going to know I fall from my from Canaan.
What was it like to have Sam Cooke in the Soul Stirrers? Since he was younger than the other members of the band, did he behave differently? And
Yep.
Yeah,
he
what was the difference?
A lot different. Mm-hmm. Well, one thing, you could never get him up in the morning on time, and he's always late, and I devised a plan to get him there on time. If the program was at 8 o'clock, I'd tell him it's 7, and so maybe we'll get him there on time. He had all of that. But whenever he got there, he ruled the roost, as we call it.
Mr. Crane, am I right that when he started singing with the Soul Stirrers, younger people in the audience, especially women people, started coming forward in the congregation the way they hadn't with Harris?
Oh, I'll tell you the truth. This is a wonderful thing. I noticed in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, I told my bass singer then, Jesse Farley, I said, Jay, did you see all these people? They didn't go to Archie Brownlee, that was one of the blind boys. They didn't go to Kyle O'Turner, and that was the Pilgrim Trail. I said, they came to Sam. And Father said, yep, I noticed him. I said, yeah, well, this must be the man. And the young people the young people used to sit in the back. But when Sam started singing, the young people came to the front. And we pushed Sister Flute in the back. And that's the older people. So we call her Sister Flute. We don't call nobody's name. And the young people push Sister Flute in the back when Sam started singing. But now when R.H. Hass was singing, Sister Flute was in the front, and she push the young people in the back. And so that's kind of the difference.
Do you think this actually brought young people closer to God or just closer to Sam Cooke?
I don't know. I'm not going to try to answer that. I don't know.
It's certainly worth looking at the fact that over in the secular world, the teenagers was being, quote-unquote, invented around this time, so that for the Platters and the Dominoes and Elvis Presley, there was something similar going on.
Daniel Wolfe, why do you think Sam Cooke wanted to cross over from gospel music to pop?
Well, you should ask me that.
Okay, I'll ask you that, Mr. Crane.
Go ahead, Mr. Crane.
The reason Sam had wanted to cross over to pop, he'd gone as far as he could go in gospel. The gospel only paid that little 10 and 15 cents that we was getting in those days. And Sam wanted to better his condition.
So you think it was for money?
Well, it was partly for money, yes. He wanted some money. He wanted the nice things. He wanted fine cars that he see. And I wanted them too.
What about the music? Did he particularly want to sing pop music?
Yeah, he wanted to. He wanted to sing it. You didn't have to urge him, because he had sense, he had the knowledge, he had the speech, he had the training, and it just fit Sam Cooke.
Now, did he tell you that this is what he wanted and almost like ask for your permission?
Yes, he asked for my opinion.
What did you tell him?
I told him, no, stay in Soul Service, because I couldn't see no further than Soul Service.
Mm-hmm.
You understand?
Oh, sure.
And of course, he could see further than me because he had better education than I had. As you can see now, my education is limited, very limited. But my knowledge, but my wisdom is very high. My wisdom is sky high.
Amen.
I ain't joking with you.
When Sam first thought about crossing over into rock and roll or pop, he tried to do it halfway. He cut a single as Dale Cooke.
Yeah.
Thinking that might fool somebody. Of course, there he was yodeling and sounding just like the man everybody knew, and I don't think it fooled anybody.
He didn't fool nobody.
Well, I'd like to play the song that made him famous as a pop singer.
You Send Me, maybe.
You Send Me, yeah. And in fact, what I'd like to do is play the demo of the song. I think he sounds great on this. It's just Sam Cooke and guitar. In fact, is that him playing guitar or is it somebody else?
No, that's Cliff White playing the guitar.
Okay.
A lot of folks thought it was Sam playing, but that was Cliff White. That's reading Cliff White is a part of us now. He played every song that Sam sang.
Cliff White, who's one of the collaborators on this book You Send Me, talked about Sam coming in to sing it for him the first time, and he said, I sat there with my guitar, and Sam taught me the chords. I started playing it, and he sung You Send Me about six times, and I thought, well, that's not too interesting. And then he got to the second verse, and the second verse was nothing but saying You Send Me over and over again, another six times. And Cliff said, this song isn't going anywhere. This one's a total failure. He ended up eating his words.
That's right.
Why don't we hear the demo of You Send Me? And this is actually featured now on a new box set CD called The Sar Story, and it's the recordings that Sam Cooke released on his own record label, a record label we'll talk about in a bit.
Okay.
This is You Send Me.
You send me when I see you. You send me whenever I hold you. You send me. Honest you do. At first I thought it was infatuation, but ooh, it's lasted so long. And now I find myself wanting to marry you and take you home, because when I'm
Daniel Wolfe, who was this demo made for?
This was made for Art Roop and the owner of Specialty Records, where he had sung gospel, and for Bumps Blackwell, who was the producer of the record. What ended up happening was he came into the studio to cut this record on a day that Art Roop was supposed to be elsewhere. And Bumps Blackwell had brought in some white backup singers. Bumps and Sam were determined not only to get out of gospel, but to leap right over R&B and end up in the pop market, which is to say the market that appealed to both whites and blacks, and therefore a much larger audience. Art Roop didn't particularly believe in that kind of music. He had major hits with Little Richard, which was a much harder sound. And when he saw the white backup singers and heard the sort of lilting sound of You Send Me, he went off. And he as much as threw Bumps and Sam out of the studio.
That's right.
They picked up the demo and headed across town and eventually signed with a tiny little label called Keen, which is the label that had the hit. And as Art Roop said later, I've been in mourning ever since. I've been wearing black ever since.
That's right.
Well, Daniel, as you point out, this was a time when it was very difficult for most black artists to cross over into the, you know, white parts of radio and record sales. Did Sam Cooke have any trouble doing that?
Well, he didn't have trouble with You Send Me, in other words, in terms of rock and roll, which was still considered a sort of mongrel music. He then, though, tried to play the Copacabana. He wanted to get into the nightclub scene as well, because there you could sell albums, and you made a lot more money on them than you did on 45s. But the first time he played the Copa, where he sang songs like Putting on My Top Hat and that sort of thing, he was a total bomb. The orchestra was going one direction, he was going another direction. The audience couldn't have cared less, and it took him a long time to get over that and to come back, and he finally did and triumphed at the Copa, but it was 6 years, 5 years later.
Mr. Cream, what was it like for you at the Copa? What did you think of the world of nightclubs?
Well, actually, by the time we got to the Copa, we had sang at Town Hill, and we had sang at the Elegante, and we'd made it, and so we begged Larry Auerbach at the agency to come out and hear us, because we knew we could get back in the Copa. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, I kind of differ with Daniel when you say he was a bum. Sam was just singing, and he did all right. But what the reason what that Sam didn't take it to Copa, it was they had a storyteller by the name of Myron Cohen.
Oh, the Borscht Belt comic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And the people that came to see Myron Cohen was old people. And, of course, Sam Cooke sang his heart out then. I knew he was singing. He knew he was singing then. He knew he was good enough. But the people that come to hear Myron Cohen was 50s and 60s, and Sam's a kid coming on there singing, Lord, You Send Me, and all that kind of mess.
Oh, sure.
And that's
well, so,
what
know,
it signed to them.
Myron Cohen was the kind of comic whose punchlines were mostly in Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
So
it was. All
he attracted an audience of older people who knew
right.
Yiddish and who would not know who Sam Cooke was or
never
probably care very much. that's interesting. My guests are Daniel Wolf, author of a new biography of Sam Cooke called You Send Me, and S.R. Crane, the founder of the gospel group The Soul Stirrers, which launched Sam Cooke's career. More after this break. This is Fresh Air.
She was on the 16, on the 16. I loved her so, but she was 16, too young to fall 16, in love, and I was too young to know. We'd laugh and 16, we'd sing and do the 16, little things that made my heart glow.
Back with Daniel Wolf, author of a new biography of Sam Cooke, and S.R. Crane, founder of the gospel group The Soul Stirrers. Daniel, here's a question for you.
Okay.
When Sam Cooke started singing pop, do you feel you hear a lot of gospel influence in his voice? And I'm wondering if you could maybe choose one of his pop records that you think has a particular connection to one of his gospel records.
Well, I think part of the development of Sam Cooke was there was always the gospel in his voice, but the longer he did rock and roll, and the more confident he became, the more he let that out. By the time you get to a song like Bring It On Home to Me, later in his career, he was being much more upfront, I think, about his gospel roots. And he was singing, on that particular song with the young Lou Rawls singing those yeahs back and forth.
Yes.
And that's call and response. I mean, that's getting Sister Flute. It's almost indistinguishable from gospel music. At the beginning, at the beginning, tunes like Wonderful World or I'll Come Running Back to You are much, he's being much more careful about sounding not white, but sounding not heavy black gospel, because he was trying to get the market.
That's well, right. Why don't we hear Bring It On Home to Me?
Great.
This is Sam Cooke.
If you ever change your mind, go about leaving, leaving me behind. Baby, bring it to me. Bring your sweet loving. Bring it on.
My guests are Daniel Wolfe, the author of a new biography of Sam Cooke called You Send Me, and S.R. Crane, who collaborated on the biography. He was the founder of the Soul Stirrers, with which Sam Cooke sang for several years. And then when Sam Cooke started his pop career, Mr. Crane became Sam Cooke's road manager.
Yes.
Let's jump ahead, well, or go backwards, depending on where we are in the story. Let's go to 1959, when Sam Cooke and you, Mr. Crane, and a third partner founded SAR Records, and the R was for your middle name.
That's right. Senior Roy is my name.
Yeah, and the S
the
was for
R
Sam.
Is Roy. So, S for Sam, Alex, and Roy.
Daniel Wolfe, you describe SAR Records as Sam Cooke's idea of the civil rights movement put into practice. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, one of the quotes in the book is from a friend of Sam's called Harold Batiste, who said, if this is our music, why don't we own it?
It
strikes me as still an important question.
It really is.
And SAR music was Sam saying, I don't always want to sing for someone else and just get a percentage of it. I want to own this business. He already owned the publishing for his songs, which was semi-revolutionary for the time. A lot of artists didn't, and a lot of artists regret it to this day because they don't have the money.
That's right.
But Sam owned his publishing, and SAR was a kind of extension of that. It was both, he hoped, a way when he couldn't sing anymore, it wasn't a teen idol, to stay in the music business. And while he was still singing, it was a way to try out ideas. So he would go there, and for example, the Sims twins were a duet who were the sort of model for Sam and Dave. And he brought them in to help sing back up on Cupid. And while they were in there, he said, I have this song called Soothe Me. Would you try recording that? They did. It was a big hit. And Sam could see that he could stay on the other side of the recording studio and turn the dials and have some say in the product as well.
Yes.
Had Sam Cooke been having problems with his labels, besides the fact that he didn't own the publishing, was he asked to do things that he didn't really want to do? Did he want more control over his material or the presentation?
Well, I tell you, this is that's a question that's hard to answer. But he didn't have any trouble. It's just some things he would do and some things he wouldn't.
Mr. Crane,
he don't care who he was.
Crane is being nice now. He's being very nice. In my opinion, he did have some trouble. I mean,
I'm a nice fellow.
You are a nice fellow. I'm just nice sometimes.
Yeah.
he went from Specialty Records, where he had this fight over You Send Me with Art Rupe, to Keen Records, which was this tiny label. And at Keen, Sam frankly didn't think he was getting the money that he should have been getting, as I understand it.
You're right.
He then went to RCA, and one of the troubles he had with RCA was they had the only other African-American artist on the label at the time, I believe, was Harry Belafonte.
Right.
And they had a real clear idea of what a black singer ought to be singing, and it wasn't Sam Cooke music.
That's right.
So the first song, for example, he released was Teenage Sonata, which, if you haven't heard of it, it's for a good reason. It is a terrible song and a terrible record. He had cut already Chain Gang, which they delayed 6 months releasing, I think because they felt it was too soulful, believe it or not, for RCA's image. When they did release it, it was a massive hit.
That's right.
So he wanted more control.
Yep.
Sam Cooke was killed at the age of 33 in 1964. He was shot through the heart and bludgeoned on the head, I believe, found in just an overcoat and one shoe in a sleazy motel. What was the official story of what happened?
The official story was that he had abducted a woman in order to rape her. She had escaped, and in searching for her, he'd broken down the door and been shot by the motel manager.
And why do you think of that as just the official story? Do you think that there's a true story that is different?
Yes.
Why?
Well, if you look for one thing, simply at the testimony at the inquest, which was a very hurried affair, it's rife with contradictions. No one seems to be able to quite get their story straight about this. As it turns out, the woman he took to the motel was arrested for prostitution a month later. Certainly a bunch of Sam Cooke's friends, as is first revealed in this book, say he knew the motel, Sam, and that he probably knew the woman. There are a lot of holes in this story that don't hold up. Among other things, I should add, there are a couple of people's testimony in here who saw him with quite a lot of money at the beginning of the evening, which he did not have by the end of the evening, and which provides a different motive and certainly a different spin on this story, I think.
So do you think the possibility is that he was robbed and murdered, or do you think there's something even more mysterious that happened?
I think he was robbed. That's my guess, and I think his clothes were taken when he was robbed, and I think in pursuing that, he ended up at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mr. Crane, what do you think?
Well, I really can't. One thing I knew Sam. And by saying that Sam wanted raping and bought that biggest lie that could ever been told. And he wouldn't rape nobody because I had to hire people to keep women off of him. He wouldn't rape nobody. And that's the big lie. And, of course, I didn't have enough money to track it down. If I'd have had it, I would have. But I just didn't have enough money. And then I knew better than to try to track up a lie. If you go to track a lie down, you lose everything you got. You lose all your money. You lose all your power. You lose all everything. So I just sat back because I know the man upstairs is going to straighten this thing. And you got to let him have it. That's my version of it.
Can I put something in here, Terry?
Yeah.
Yes.
One of the sad things in terms of Sam's career about when he died was he had just recorded and released a song called The Change Is Gonna Come.
And that's right.
And if there was ever a moment when gospel music met pop music in a beautiful meeting, it is that song, which I think is as intelligent and moving a discussion of the civil rights movement and the history of African Americans in this country as we have in music. It's a great, great song.
Well, I think it's a beautiful note to end on. I thank you both enormously for talking with us. Thank you, Daniel Wolfe. Thank you, S.R. Crane.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Daniel Wolfe is the author of a new biography of Sam Cooke called You Send Me, written in collaboration with S.R. Crane, the founder of the gospel group The Soul Stirrers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Ever since, it's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Director Adam Egoyan's new film Exotica is being hailed as his breakthrough movie. It won the International Critics Prize at last year's Cannes Film Festival. Egoyan set this film in a strip club. It's not the first time Egoyan has used voyeurism as a theme. His 1991 film, The Adjuster, featured a porn-obsessed censor. Asked about why he has returned to this theme, Egoyan once remarked, "That is what film is all about, making or watching images because you like to watch." A conversation with Canadian film director Adam Egoyan coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Secretary of State Christopher says he and the Russian foreign minister agreed today to establish a working group to discuss nuclear issues. Christopher says the group will discuss topics including Russia's plan to sell nuclear power plants to Iran. Christopher says he told Foreign Minister Kozarev during their meeting in Geneva that the U.S. is strongly opposed to the sale. Russia's top foreign intelligence officer dismisses U.S. concerns about Russia's deal to sell nuclear reactors to Iran and confirms Russia's commitment to go ahead with it. NPR's Anne Garrels reports.
Foreign Intelligence Service Director Yevgeny Primakov told a press conference that after considering voluminous material, Russia has concluded there is no convincing evidence Iran is carrying out a coherent nuclear military program. Russia has signed a contract worth between $800 million and $1 billion to help Iran build a nuclear plant. U.S. officials argue this will make it easier for Iran to develop nuclear weapons. Primakov's statement came as he recommended the open-ended extension of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. This is to be debated at an international conference next month. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
Japanese police want to question the leader of a secretive religious sect about Monday's nerve gas attack on the Tokyo subway system. In raids at the sect's compound today and yesterday, authorities found chemicals that could be used in making sarin. That was the nerve gas used in the subway attack. The BBC's Katie Kay reports.
Police told Kyodo that they want to find out whether the substances discovered on the sect's premises have anything to do with the attack on the Tokyo Underground. This is the first official indication that police are linking Ohm with the attacks. Ohm's lawyer has said that the group's leader, Shoko Asahara, is prepared to cooperate with investigators, but the lawyer didn't disclose the leader's whereabouts. Some of the chemical products found during raids on the group's headquarters could be used to make the lethal nerve gas sarin, which was responsible for killing 10 people in Monday's attack. Police have now suspended raids on the group's premises because they've found toxic substances which they don't want to touch until they receive specialist backup from anti-chemical warfare units. But so far, no one from the sect has actually been charged with Monday's attack.
Caddy Kay in Tokyo. The U.S. and Japan are going back to their difficult negotiations on trade in cars and car parts. U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor says the U.S. team from his office in the Commerce Department will go to Japan and resume talks on Monday. The U.S. wants Japan to open its markets to more American automotive products. Stock prices closed higher on Wall Street today. The Dow closed up 4 points to end the day at a new record high of 4087.83. Advances edged out declines. This is NPR. The French foreign minister warned Turkey today of a possible penalty for its military assault into Iraq against Kurdish guerrillas. Alain Juppé said the incursion makes it harder to win European Parliament approval for a trade agreement between Turkey and the European Union. The agreement, reached with Turkey earlier this month, would lead to more Turkish goods entering European markets and possibly a step toward integration with the rest of Europe. Informant Michael Fitzpatrick says the federal government agreed to pay him $45,000 for cooperating in the prosecution of Malcolm X's daughter. Kabila Shabazz is accused of plotting to murder Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan. Tom Fudge of Minnesota Public Radio reports.
News of the payments to Fitzpatrick came out today as he testified in a pretrial hearing in the case against Kabila Shabazz, who allegedly enlisted Fitzpatrick's help in the plot to kill Farrakhan. Defense attorney William Kunstler says Fitzpatrick's testimony about government payments shows the government's key witness has financial motivation to lie about the case. But Kunstler says Fitzpatrick's testimony that he fully consented to have his conversations with Shabazz recorded won't help the defense motion to suppress evidence of the tape recordings.
I can't say that I feel very optimistic, but there's a lot of material there for cross-examination.
Under questioning, Fitzpatrick also revealed he was using cocaine around the time he agreed to inform on Shabazz. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Fudge in St. Paul.
Biologists say they've been looking in today on the wolves in Yellowstone National Park, who are staying in their holding pens rather than running to freedom. The wolves were brought in from Canada in January to reestablish the wolf population in Yellowstone and were put in the one-acre pens to help them get used to the area. But when biologists finally opened the pens, the wolves showed no signs of wanting to leave. The scientists say they're confident the wolves will get out when they get hungry. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Adam Egoyan says his new film, Exotica, is about not trusting appearances. The film is set in a Toronto strip club called Exotica. But the motivations of the people who work there and the clientele are never what you expect. Village Voice film critic Jay Hoberman describes Exotica as a disturbing and ultimately heartbreaking erotic reverie. In a New York Times review, Karen James says, despite its lurid-sounding subject, Exotica turns out to be less erotic than eerie. It raises moral questions of guilt and responsibility. Exotica won the International Critics Prize at the Cannes Film Festival. Several of Egoyan's earlier films, such as The Adjuster and Speaking Parts, also won International Film Festival awards. Here's a scene from Exotica featuring Elias Koteas as the club's MC. He takes the mic to stimulate the clientele's fantasies and to convince the men to pay the $5 that it takes to bring one of the naked dancers to your personal table.
Let's bring those big hairy palms together, gentlemen. Give it up. Yeah, gentlemen, yes. Have a nice big round of applause for Linda. Yeah. Yes, indeed, Linda. And just a reminder that there's nothing Linda would love more than to slink over to your table and give you your own private show for only $5. That's right. $5 is all it takes to have one of our beautiful foxes come over to your table and get you all hot and bothered. But hey, why be bothered when you're being treated like a king? You've had a rough day. Don't you think you owe it to yourselves to do something that'll make you feel like you're someone special? You are someone special. $5 is all it takes to prove it.
Now, a lot of the film is set in a strip club called Exotica.
Right.
And a club like that might symbolize just, you know, perversity for many people, but it's really in some ways the safest place in the film because there are rules that have to be followed.
Right.
Like the clientele can't touch the strippers. What made you think about a sex club as possibly one of the safer places?
I think that all the characters are in a strange situation where their own sexuality has come to represent something other than what it should be. It has almost transformed itself into an odd expression of their psychological need beyond the physical. So the club, which is a celebration of all things physical, has this very strict rule of not touching. So there's a paradox there, and I found that tension to be really fascinating. It's something that really has compelled me for a long time. I mean, why would someone go to a club with the idea of achieving some sort of intimacy, but knowing that the very grounds for an intimate contact, which is some sort of touch, is denied them? That was really a very fascinating situation to explore. And I think there's something very comfortable or comforting, ultimately, about being in a place which deals with so many things which are mysterious to us and so taboo, such as our sexual desire, but also has very, very strict rules, so that you know what the parameters are, you know how far you can go. And I think that is really what the attraction of these clubs is all about.
in this club for $5, one of the dancers will come to your table and dance just for you.
Right.
And this is a really interesting public-private thing. It should be a really private experience, right? Somebody arousing you just right. inches away from you. On the other hand, it's a really public setting, and everybody is watching you being aroused by the dancer.
Well, there's something very tribal about it, ultimately, and I think that's one of the attractions of these clubs as well, that you are. It's the closest thing we have in our society, perhaps, to a bacchanal, you know, this idea that sexual pleasure and activity is a collective experience. We just don't really have any outlets for that, and I think that societies throughout history have always had some sort of event where there was a public expression of sensual pleasure, and a strip club is probably the only thing that we have that comes close to that. And it's also very territorial, obviously, because when you hire someone to come to your table and dance for you, you are also making it known to the other people in that club that you have actually purchased the right to have that person for that period of time. So you're playing out something else as well. I mean, you're playing out your attraction to that particular dancer, but I think as important, you're playing out the fantasy that you have some territorial right to own that person. So there's something darker as well there, and I think that there's so many contradictions in a club like that, that it's irresistible for a dramatist to explore that.
Did you go to clubs like Exotica?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's a real phenomenon up here. And I think there are some cities in the States as well where people will actually go to those places knowing that you know, those clubs are popular.
What was your mood when you visited the clubs? Did you find the clubs you know, kind of exciting in their own way, or depressing, because there can be something really depressing about watching people dance for money like that, and watching the people who maybe their only way of getting sexually aroused is to come to a club and pay.
Yeah, you can't generalize. I think that you have to really understand that there are a wealth of experiences that bring people either to watch dancers in that club or to actually allow a person to feel comfortable about dancing in the club. I met so many different people, and they all had different reasons as to why they were there. Some of them were really proud and quite excited to be dancing in the clubs because it allowed them to do something that they felt they were good at and to earn a lot of money. Other people you really felt were there for reasons outside of their own control. So you can't generalize. I think by the same token, you can't really generalize about the type of people who go to those clubs. I mean, there are people who are there because, as you said, it is their only outlet, their only way of having access to a naked body. But there are also people who are there for very casual reasons. I mean, they just like the environment of those places. They feel like they're in the middle of a party that doesn't end, and they feel some sort of sense of sanctuary in the anonymity of being a viewer in those places. So there's so many different reasons, and I think that one of the real challenges in making Exotica was not to moralize about, you know, why people are there, but to present it as an environment, to present it as a workplace with all the contradictions and all of the complexities of any workspace.
There's an MC at the club in your movie who's played by Elias Koteas.
Right.
And he raps to the men at the club about how arousing it would be to pay the $5 and
right.
to bring one of the dancers over to your table. I really like this performance a lot. And the actor really reminded me of two actors in Taxi Driver, both Harvey Keitel and Robert De Niro.
That's very interesting you should say that, because everyone always talks about how Elias reminds him of De Niro, but I really think that the energy of that particular character was inspired by the Keitel character.
The character of sport.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right, sport. You know, and I mean, it's a funny role, because what he's actually doing with his job, where he's trying to whip up some sort of excitement around the dancers and to get people to pay to bring them over to their tables, what he's actually saying is so funny, if you know anything about those clubs, because it would just make anyone squirm. I mean, he's so He deconstructs what the nature of these men's attraction to the dancers is, and that's the last thing that that job really allows for. I mean, I think that the whole point of that job is to create this effortless sense of transition between having a dancer on stage and imagining what it would take to invite them to your table. But, you know, he actually makes that really a very tortured process, and it's quite funny.
My guest is Adam Egoyan, the writer, director, and producer of the new film Exotica. Back after a break. This is Fresh Air. The secrets that are revealed in your films sometimes have to do with sex, or with voyeurism, with pornography. Is that because, well, it's a good dramatic device, or does it go deeper than that?
Well, I'm fascinated by sex. I'm fascinated by my own sexual impulses. I'm fascinated by what it is that makes me desire or dream of certain things, and I think most people are. I mean, I think that sex is an aspect of our own personalities that we feel uncomfortable about talking about sometimes, but it's such a motivating, you know, factor. Even the suppression of sex, you know. I mean, to me, it's a currency that we trade with in most of our day-to-day transactions. And
Here's a question that you might not feel comfortable answering, but do you ever, for instance, like rent pornography at a video store? And if so, do you feel really uncomfortable about it and try to, you know, pretend like it's, you know, Forrest Gump or something that you're really renting?
I'm not embarrassed about, you know, my fascination with pornography, because I think that anyone from my generation, you know, was exposed or had their own sexualities revealed through the benefit of pornography. And in some ways, it's almost strange that I can have a nostalgic relationship with, you know, Miss Penthouse 1973, because somehow that image is so ingrained into my subconscious, you know, that, I mean, it's part of our experience in this society. And that's why I get really angry when people have simplistic or moralistic views about, you know, the role or the effect of pornography on our makeup. You know, now I'm not suggesting that, you know, this is a completely healthy situation. I mean, I think that's why I make the films I do, because there are obvious problems when you surrender yourself so completely to images which are themselves manipulations and which you have no control over. And I think you do have to address at a certain level what it was that went into the making of those images. And there are certain parameters that I think the law has to guard. I mean, I do believe that there are people who are exploited in the making of those images, and that that process is really ugly. But we do live with those images. We are constituted by those images, and we have to understand our relationship to those images.
Well, that leads me to decisions you probably had to make while shooting the scenes in the club Exotica, which is how consciously arousing you wanted the dances to be.
Well, I wanted the dances and the environment to be seductive. I wanted the club to be a place that the viewer would want to go to. I wanted it to be full of images that you just barely saw, and that sense of peripheral recognition would somehow make it all the more exciting. That by not focusing on the nudity, but rather having it sort of always there, but in a sort of out of focus or peripheral way, it would create a greater sense of excitement. But at the same time, that was part of my overall project of showing where this character, the central character of Francis, was located, that he had found a relationship which was therapeutic for him for non-sexual reasons in the middle of a sex club. And what was the effect of that? And where did he find himself as a result of this particular project he had? So, you know, it's I was aware of, you know, of choosing and designing and creating this club with the effect, which is actually quite different from the from what most people feel when they go into a strip club, which is that these places, for the most part, are really depressing and uninteresting. But I wanted to create a club that was unlike that.
Adam Egoyan is my guest. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We have a story tonight involving the State Department and the Congress and the CIA. Jennifer Harbury was married to a Mayan Indian leftist guerrilla fighting against the government of Guatemala. She's been on two hunger strikes to protest his disappearance. She's now found out that her husband indeed was killed, the execution ordered by an officer who had some ties to the Central Intelligence Agency. And Ms. Harbury wasn't told about that. I'll talk with her about this case and her efforts to learn the truth in Guatemala and in Washington. Pete Wilson, California's governor, is leaning toward a presidential bid. We'll have a report on Mr. Wilson's record. Lynn Neary on affirmative action, the moral arguments involved in the issue.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Adam Egoyan is my guest, and he directed the new film, Exotica. Let me ask you a little bit about your background. I know you are of Armenian heritage. You were born in Cairo, grew up in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
What got your parents to move from Cairo to Canada?
Well, I think at the time there was sort of an uprising in Arab nationalism, and a lot of the minorities were sort of frightened about their situation in Egypt, and so... it was a time when a lot of Armenians did leave the country. This was in, 1962, mm-hmm. early 60s.
Can I ask your religious background?
Well, most Armenians are Orthodox Christian, and that was certainly my background, though my parents were not really practicing, because we couldn't really. I was raised in a town where we were the only Armenian family, so there was no community or no church to speak of.
I was thinking of the idea of religious guilt, since so many of your themes have to do with sexuality.
I think that I had a pretty open view of sexuality, because both my parents are painters, and I was very aware of them using sexuality in their own work and exploring sexuality in their own work, and also of having nude models, you know, around the house. And so I had a pretty open view of sexuality. I think one of the funnier experiences in my childhood was the fact that because my father did a lot of figure painting, he always had a lot of Playboy magazines around, and would use them as a cheap form of finding models. And my friends were always so fascinated by that. And I remember this one time, my friends, this is when I was about 10 years old, asked me to steal some of these magazines and bring them to this tree fort they had. And I remember it was very odd, because these magazines were so commonplace in my house, but suddenly they were invested with this sense of taboo,
mm-hmm.
and this transformation of an object which was so ordinary into something which was mystified, and the object of desire was something I very, very specifically remember going into his studio and taking these magazines and stealing them, and then feeling incredibly guilty about that, because I felt that I had somehow betrayed something in my relationship to my parents, which was a recognition of their artistry and the freedom of expression. I had somehow taken something and made it into something which it wasn't. So maybe that was a formative experience for me.
Did your father find out?
Yes, he did, and he was just sort of bewildered about it. Like, why would I just asked him, or why wouldn't I have just borrowed them? But, you know, What happened was that one of the other parents had found out about this cache in this tree fort and was absolutely indignant that my parents would have that sort of material around the house. And anyway, I mean, it's an interesting story.
Have your parents seen your movies?
Oh yes, of course. Yeah.
I always figure it must be really uncomfortable to do anything artistically that has to do with sexuality and have your parents see it. But of course, if your parents were working with nudes all the time, then
yeah,
they're probably pretty comfortable around the subject matter.
Yes, I mean, it's I think sometimes they wonder what I'm up to, and they certainly are. I think my father sometimes probably feels a bit threatened, but never in a way that we can't discuss, so that's good. What's more unusual sometimes is where there are certain things that have happened in their own lives, and they are looking for clues in the film which are not intended or which are not necessarily meant as indicators of something that happened to them, but they see that way, you know.
Well, that's really scary, isn't it? To have friends or family kind of interpreting your relationship with them through watching your movies.
Yeah. It is, but I think it's a matter of keeping it as open a dialogue about that as possible.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the most dangerous thing in any sort of relationship is the unnecessary mystification of something, because it's something we're all very attracted to. I mean, we all want to mystify our own desire and our own sense of attraction, but that's also the moment at which we abstract our own emotions and we transform people into something that they're not. And that is something that I think we just have to keep a dialogue open.
Well, Adam Egoyan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Adam Egoyan wrote, directed, and produced the new film Exotica. It's already playing in many cities and opens in 500 more cities tomorrow. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf and Alan Tu, who also directed the show. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Our interns are Sienna Chrisman and Zeb Esselstyn. I'm Jerry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Academy Awards will be presented Monday night on the next archive edition of Fresh Air. Interviews with three of this year's nominees for Best Supporting Actor. Gary Sinise, nominated for Forrest Gump, Chaz Palminteri, Bullets Over Broadway, and Samuel Jackson, Pulp Fiction. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.